Good afternoon and welcome to Lunch with Leaders. I'm your host, Cindy Morgan, the Vice President of Learning and Organizational Development, and I'm lucky enough to run the Penn Medicine Academy. Thank you for joining us. I'm really glad that you're here. I really want today to be an amazing conversation, both with you as well as our guests. Let me turn it over to Youngin Cho from PMA to give you a couple of tips for how you can participate fully. Youngin, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you, Cindy?
I'm good, Youngin.
Thanks everyone for joining Lunch with Leaders today. Some of you may have joined the book club last night, which was amazing, with Kevin Amaro, and he said this is exactly the topic that he touched on, that there's going to be acceleration of trend in technology and AI, and it's the soft skills, the social skills, being able to manage difficult conversations, that's going to be the key differentiator. So it's going to be so important for you as a leader and for your team. So we're so glad you're here to join in the conversation. We love hearing from you. So get your cell phones ready for the poll. Use the chat and the Q&A window for questions. We'll try to get to as many as we can. And Casey, if you could advance. We will continue to provide the texting feature to get the CMEC credit, which is open right now. So if you have a profile, text 72569 to 215-398-6728. The event handout is on the LeadStrong website. And for any questions, reach out to the CME office. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
Thanks, Youngin, and thanks for all your work on making sure today's show is great. So welcome back. For those who've been here before, for those who are new, we're really happy that you're here. Lunch with Leaders is an opportunity for us to come together in community as leaders to talk about issues that are really important to each of us. I think that I know I learn just as much from our guests as I do from you in the chat. So your participation is appreciated. And I think of you as one of the panelists also. So I love it when you participate. So thank you for bringing your wisdom into this community and into the conversation. Let me call on all my super fans. I'd love for you to share the LeadStrong website. I think it's like, remember how Seinfeld, like the first year, most people weren't watching it. And then it like caught on like wildfire because the super fans were like, you got to watch this. You got to see what Jerry says next. Well, we need you, our super fans, to be sharing the LeadStrong webpage because there's so much good content over the past year that I think we really could benefit our community by getting it out there. So do us a favor. Share your favorite episodes. Tell your friends. Have them come with you live or at least have them watch the playback. It would mean a lot to us. So let's talk mailbag. How good was the last show? Jan, Charmaine, I feel like they both kind of ripped open their chests and we saw their hearts in the conversation and you felt that way. I know I did. Got some really nice feedback. I got to shout out the glow, the gorgeous ladies of experience from Lancaster. They shared with me in confidence, and then I asked for their permission, their live chat. You know how some people live tweet sporting events? People are live texting each other during Lunch with Leaders. I was like so flattered and I think it's so awesome. Love their conversation. And Grace, I agree. Charmaine, she is a boss ass lady. Bang. All right. We got your survey feedback. Thank you for all that participated. Again, we really listened to your feedback because we want to create a show that you want to come to. So when we said, who would you like to see on the show? Most people said, you're doing fine with picking the guests, which is really cool. We're going to keep picking them, but anytime you have input in terms of who you'd like, shoot us a name. Regina Cunningham definitely topped the list, so we hope to have her soon. We also heard clearly and loudly, keep having our guests share their stories. It's inspiring, and we aim to please. So again, keep that feedback coming. All right, we got a couple of big commercials this week. Youngin pointed out the book club. I'd love to hear any feedback from people who went to book club last night. What'd you think? You think we should keep doing book club? Let us know what you liked about the conversation. If you missed it, not to worry. We're going to send out the replay to everyone next week. So be on the lookout in the COVID update or in a general email. I know this is really hard to believe, but Gretchen, Youngin, me, we do other stuff besides just Lunch with Leaders. I know, go figure. We just sent out the new program that we're launching. It launched yesterday in your inbox. There should be a communication, Penn Medicine ACHE Leadership Program. We're pumped about this one. Let me turn it back over to Youngin to do the commercial. She has worked so hard with Gretchen Kolb on this. I got to make sure she gets the commercial in. Youngin, thanks for the great work. Tell us about this exciting program. Give us the deets.
Yeah, so I'm so excited to talk about this. And this is just a little highlight because we do have a whole session dedicated to talk more about this program. So this is Penn Medicine ACHE Leadership Program. Kevin is an active member of ACHE, American College of Healthcare Executives, where Kevin recently presented at a large national event. At Penn Medicine, we have about 80 members and 19 fellows. So, in a nutshell, this is a targeted development program for 40 high potential physician and administrative leaders across the system with a goal of becoming the fellows of ACHE. So, after being a member for a year, you can sit for the Board of Governors exam to become the fellow. This really is a great program which really marries the best of Penn Medicine and ACHE. So, by incorporating leaders as teachers model, we'll have our senior executives teach the Penn Medicine way while earning your credits towards the exam to ultimately get the FACHE credential. So, as PMA is now a credit provider of ACHE, everything we do, you can apply as a credit. So, attaining the fellowship is a big component and commitment of the program. And so there are a few criteria that are set by ACHE to be able to sit for the exam. So you need to hold the healthcare management position and have a direct reports and have significant time devoted to managerial accountabilities like staffing and departmental planning. You need to have 5 years of healthcare management experience and a master's degree. There are a few other criteria like the voluntary activities, but we'll coordinate that with you during the year-long program. The selection process is through self-nomination, so please apply by May 21st. The initial list will be reviewed by the entity leadership, who will make recommendations to the senior leadership team, and you'll be notified by July. So in summer, we'll get the ACHE membership started with some assessment, and the program will formally start in September. Casey, if you can advance the next slide. So we have a full website dedicated to this program with information, detailed eligibility criteria, key date, FAQs, and invite you to join the virtual session next Tuesday. We'll give you more information, and most importantly, we'll have the current fellows to share the experience on why they chose to become the fellows, how it has helped them, what it was like to sit and prepare for the exam. So please join us. The session will be recorded, but there's nothing like being on live. So as always, discuss the opportunity with your manager, explore the website, and reach out with any questions.
Youngin, thanks so much. You'll definitely want to go to this info session. Michelle Volpe tells an amazing story of how she can remember going up the escalator to take the exam and like what it felt like to be her in that moment. She'll tell it again and it will be much better than I could do. All right, Casey, if we can advance, we got a second commercial for you today. So in the survey, someone wrote to us last week saying, "Is it ever too old to go back to school?" And boy, that really touched me. I mean, I feel that. My motto in life is ABL, always be learning. It's a little different from the motto at Penn Medicine, ABB, always be budgeting. But always be learning is like something that is really near and dear to my heart. So I appreciated that person's courage for saying, I really am thinking about this. We have a program for you, as well as some of your staff and fellow members of the community who might be having that same question, but a little nervous about it. We have an amazing program that's coming up. This will be our second time doing this. And it's really in our collaboration with our partners in benefits who are awesome. We're talking about undergraduate and graduate programs and selecting the best fit. So we want to review all of the things that you can do with your tuition benefit, how it works. We want to talk a little bit about how you pick a place that's going to be the right place for you. So this is a 45-minute virtual quarterly information session. It will give you all of the dates that you need to know to be thinking about this maybe a little bit more seriously. April 29th at noon, it will be recorded. And again, like Youngin said, there's nothing like being able to have your questions answered real time. So if you maybe you already have your master's or stuff that you're not looking for a formal program, we love it when you're here with us learning, but pass it along. I think it could be really good for the right people. Okay, let's talk about today. It is going to be good. As you can imagine, I get a lot of phone calls. like one of the cool parts of my job. People call, they have hard problems or challenges that they've got to figure out. So we talk it through, and about 75% of every one of these phone calls, at some point I say, have you confronted that? Have you had the difficult conversation? Have you spoken the unspoken? Invariably, the same thing happens. There's a pause. And then I hear like a groan. Oh, and boy, I feel that. Having difficult conversations, it's really tough. I don't know if any of us are great at it or love it. That might be a little bit sick. But there can be tips to make it easier. So that's what we're going to focus on today. This is the big show. Besides financial acumen, people consistently say, can you help me get better at difficult conversations? And boy, do we have an expert with us today. You're going to feel like you got a couple of things that you can implement coming out of this session that will be pragmatic and magical simultaneously. So those are the objectives of what we're going to have. We love hearing from you. I really want to hear your tips as well, because no doubt you've had to have hard conversations, and I'm sure some of them have gone really well, and maybe some haven't, and you've learned all the same. So we want to hear from you. So I got to hear from you, though. How are you doing? Let's pull out our cell phones. This is the audience participation. Using your cell phone, please text Penn Medicine 918 to 22333. You'll be in the survey. If you have a problem, just let G know in the chat. And let me know, what are the emotions you're feeling today? How are you doing? Pulse check time. It's a chilly April day. I'd love to know how you're doing. And in the meantime, while we wait for your responses, let me introduce our guest for today. Katherine Morrison is coming to us. She is a negotiation and conflict management expert who helps leaders like me, like you, become better at resolving conflict and navigating and negotiating effective change. Katherine, she'll tell you her background, but she just gets it. She is an attorney by training and has spent the majority of her career working with leaders like us in academic medicine. Her consulting clients include Columbia, Duke, Hopkins, NYU. That's where I met her. So I like kept in touch with Katherine because she's a special one. She's the two-time recipient of the Best of Hopkins Teaching Award from the graduates of the MBA program at Hopkins School of Business of Medicine MBA program. She's won a lot of teaching awards. Outside of the classroom, a little known fact, she's a world record holder in powerlifting. Maybe she'll even tell us about that. Katherine, please join me. I'm so happy that you're here. You can come on to video now and audio.
Hey, Sydney.
Hi. Hi, Catherine. I'm
Hi.
so glad you're here. So, Catherine, let's see how people are feeling. Let's go to the poll case, if you don't mind. All right, let's see. Overwhelmed, exhausted, hopeful, tired, anxious. Smiley face, thumbs up. Happy, weary, focused. Okay, all right, blessed. Thursday, accomplished. Catherine, did these words surprise you?
No. The overwhelmed concerns me, and I'm not surprised, and I do understand.
Yeah. Oh, happy's making a comeback. That's good too.
Okay, good.
So a real balancing, recharging, a real balance between, some of the harder words and some of the more positive words. I think that this is going to be critical, Catherine, as it plays into our conversation, because knowing that our leadership team are having a lot of these feelings, that may or may not fall into how we manage some of the strategies for having difficult conversations, knowing that people are feeling pretty difficult or having difficult feelings. Before we go there, let's talk about you. How'd you get into this work? Tell me your career journey to have you become an expert. I know your history, and it gives me a lot of it makes me smile and just know we're learning from a master. So would you mind telling our audience?
Sure. So first of all, for those of you who have not had a straight arrow trajectory to what it is that you do now, I'm with you. I had a very, in some ways, meandering career path, and it was punctuated by some epiphanies that led me to what I do today. I majored in elementary education. I was very interested in teaching math science at an elementary level to get young girls excited about those prospects. I graduated in a teaching glut. There were no teaching jobs to be had. So I went on a different direction and ended up working in the community college system, learned about grants and contracts, money, and then was recruited by the University of Texas Medical Branch and became a departmental administrator in a basic science department.
And I loved academic medicine. I loved the culture. I loved the idea that if I did what I did well, it could help people save lives, change worlds. You know, it was just a very energizing place. And while I was there, I realized I wanted to make academic medicine my career. I didn't have an advanced degree. A mentor suggested I was going to need one. For better or for worse, I saw healthcare and research becoming increasingly legalistic. So my first epiphany was I decided all the administrators of the future were going to be lawyers. So I left academic medicine. I actually went to law school at Penn. It's my alma mater. And my plan was to practice law for about 3 to 5 years and come back to academic medicine when I finished. I didn't want to be a legal counsel. I wanted to be fluent in a language that a lot of people in healthcare didn't speak, and be able to translate and troubleshoot. I came back and worked in kind of general administration. I was on a team that negotiated the annual contract between the medical school and the hospital. I managed internal and external audits. I got promoted and managed human resources and affirmative action. Liked what I was doing. My career goal at that time was to become a vice president for administration. So I had the basic science background. I started to learn a lot of the general issues. I didn't know enough about the clinical side, so I started looking for a job with clinical opportunities and moved into a departmental administrator role in pediatrics at Penn State University. Started teaching in medical humanities, and while I was there, the financing of healthcare started to change significantly and the level of conflict rose. And it seemed to me that it made transacting more difficult. It made people feel bad. They were there for altruistic reasons. Why didn't this work? So I decided to get trained as a mediator and started working in a community mediation center, and then gradually morphed into teaching and training in negotiation and conflict management and academic medicine. And I did that for 27 years.
You personify ABL, always be learning. I also love that it definitely was the long and winding road, and I'm really happy our roads have connected. So, Catherine, most people, they really don't feel so comfortable with conflict. There's a lot of groaning that happens when they have to have a difficult conversation. What's the best mindset to have when approaching conflict?
Number one, conflict is normal. It is a natural part of the human experience. It doesn't mean relations are broken. It doesn't mean people are bad. It doesn't necessarily mean they're dysfunctional. It just means that there is some level of friction. So when I think about conflict, what I think about is energy. The good news is somebody's experiencing conflict, there's energy around it. And so I think conflict conversations or difficult conversations are a form of energy management. And well-managed energy does amazing things. It moves things forward. It provides the backdrop for a program like this. Poorly managed energy does things like Chernobyl. So what I want to think about with a conflict conversation is at least I've got somebody who's engaged. They care. I care. How can we manage that energy for forward movement?
That's excellent. I'd like to go to the audience to say, okay, when you have that moment where you know you're going to get ready for a difficult conversation, what are some of the things you do to set your mind in a place where you can have a productive conversation? Catherine, we have talked extensively at Penn Medicine about giving feedback, trying to create a feedback-rich culture of both positives as well as opportunities for development. Is there a difference between giving feedback, having a difficult conversation, and having a conflict conversation? How do you see those differently?
Well, feedback doesn't necessarily have any conflict in it. It can be positive feedback. It can be constructive feedback. But particularly if it's a part of your communication routine, if it's the way you lead and manage on a regular basis, generally that takes away a lot of the conflict potential or conflict presence. A difficult conversation is basically any conversation can be difficult if the issue is important to you and the outcome is uncertain. So that it could be as simple as making social plans with a family member or a friend if you really care about what it is that you want to do. And so that becomes somewhat, that can challenge it. So that if you have strong feelings of all kinds, positive or negative, about the other party, that can make a conversation difficult. If I deeply care about a friendship, if I have an intense romantic relationship with someone and we want to talk about something, that can make it potentially difficult. And if I feel my self-esteem might be at risk. so that anytime the story you tell yourself about yourself feels threatened, a conversation becomes difficult. And thanks. All of those things can be part of a conversation, a conflict conversation, sometimes not.
Thanks. People really had some good mindset tips, deep breathing, reviewing the facts, honesty, trying to move myself to the position of observing myself, a little meta perspective there from Sarah, so they can react less emotionally, focusing on the objectivity of the subject. Thanks, Andrea. Plan, rehearse, think through possible options and alternatives. I think all those are good ones. Would you mind talking to us about your model that you teach in terms of navigating difficult conversations and maybe a couple of basic principles or best practices? It seems like some of those might be involved in that.
Sure. So the model that I teach, I get to do this thing, is based on difficult conversations, a book that was written by Stone, Patton, and Heen. I think it's the finest work that's ever come out of the Harvard Negotiation Project, and they do some amazing stuff. There are other very fine books, Crucial Conversations, about difficult conversations, but this is the model that I like the most. And in terms of some tips before we look at the model, the first one, can you take the slide back just one step for a second, is that often in a difficult conversation, what we want to do is give somebody a message. I don't like what you did. What you said was offensive to me. I don't like the direction that this project is going. And the first thing to remember is message delivery is not problem solving. And so that message delivery often can be more like throwing a grenade and sort of stepping back to watch it blow doesn't lead to problem solving. So the first pointer I would have in terms of readying myself or somebody else for a difficult conversation is the message you want to deliver is important. The problem solving is what's going to take this place, this someplace. So now let's look at the next slide.
Yeah, thanks.
So next slide. Five steps in the model. First one, preparation. Somebody mentioned that in the comments. If you have the luxury of preparing, sometimes difficult conversations parachute into our lives in the moment. But if you have the luxury of preparing, do it. And the way to think about that is to kind of sort out or unbraid, if you will, the three conversations. What are the three conversations? In your head, the what happened conversation, which tends to be somewhat factual, although what happened is a very objective experience. The feelings conversation, how does what's happening or what has happened or what's about to happen make me feel? And the third conversation, the one that I think is most frequently overlooked, is the identity conversation. How does what's going on affect the story that I tell myself about myself? How does it affect my identity? Because if I feel my identity is at risk, it's almost like an identity quake, I'm more likely to have a higher emotional content. So what can I unbraid about that? And then secondly, what's my intention in having the conversation? So we all have to remember, personality transplants have yet to be clinically approved. If my intention is to change you, I probably need a different plan. You know, if my intention, you know, depending on what my intention is, I may need not to have the conversation to have that intention occur. Is it something I can solve another way? Is it something I can take care of myself? But first of all, just check your own intentions. Are they honorable? Are they realistic? And are they timely? And then decide. Because what I don't like people to do is put themselves in unnecessarily high-risk conversations. I don't advocate martyrdom, so be thinking about that. And then the heart of the model from this book, Difficult Conversations, is this concept of the third story. So it's talking about and try to frame a conversation about what's the difference between your story and that of the other party. And can you open the conversation in that way? So that I can recall at one point, I was a pediatrics administrator. I worked for a marvelous chair. I admired him greatly. We had a mandate from the dean that we had to address some problems in our budget. And he was somebody who was about building and creating and designing. And I was kind of in the position to be the person to either say no or say, let's think about it. I might have started a difficult conversation with him with saying, you know, you and I right now probably have some different perspectives on the importance of continuing to expand these five initiatives. And I'd like to better understand how you see it. Then I'd like to talk to you about what my concerns are. And then let's talk about how to go forward. So a third story is it's the difference in our perspective, as opposed to a message delivery would be, there you go again. We're over budget. You've just sent me 5 new initiatives that require some appropriations. So that's a message delivery, and that's likely to immediately raise resistance. Fourth step is to actually have the conversation, to hear the other party's stories. And in most difficult conversations, I try to, and I encourage the people I coach, to let the other person go first before I tell my story. However, there are some times when I would put a caveat on that. If I'm having a difficult conversation with my supervisor or somebody higher in the organization than I, at my initiation, I don't want to tease out their story. I'm using their time. I'm renting their brain space. I need to get my story out first and then check in with theirs. A similar situation is if I'm dealing with someone who is a deeply reflective thinker, perhaps a little higher on the introversion scale, rather than putting them on the spot up front, I'm going to do my story to give them both information and thinking time. And then the last part of that model is to actively engage in problem solving.
Oh, so many good tips. Let me ask the audience, have you put any of these tips into practice, and what have the results been? I'd also ask you, do you have a different model that you work with when you're preparing for these conversations? Would love to hear from you in the chat about what's worked in terms of this model. Catherine, what I appreciate most about the model, well, there are a lot of things. I would say that you're really being thoughtful and tailoring it to set you and the other party up for a good result, and I appreciate that very much. How do you think emotional intelligence plays into handling these types of conversations?
I think it's huge. I think it's really important. And if we could just take a look at the third slide for a minute. This is a quote from Carrie Patterson. Carrie was one of the people who wrote the initial book, Crucial Conversations. And what Patterson says is, in conversations, respect is like air. If you take it away, it's all people can think about. And I link that to emotional intelligence, because a part of that emotional intelligence is thinking about things like respect, like environment, like framing, and being aware of where the other person is or might be, and creating the space to find out. So that one of the challenges in any conversation, particularly one that's difficult, is that very often I may have good intentions, but the impact of my words may be different than what I intended. And so I need to use my emotional intelligence skills to check for impact and to continue to clarify intention, to bring things into the public conversation, because so much of what we go into a conversation with is in our head, and we kind of assume that the other person already knows. And oftentimes they don't. We also assume that we know what they think, and oftentimes we don't. So I think these kinds of conversations are a rich opportunity to learn something about yourself and about somebody else.
Regina Bristow echoed some of your sentiments in terms of being mindful of your intentions. She said that just as you were saying, and I think you guys are in sync. I love it. I think that's really helpful, and many people thought it was a powerful quote, and I do too, for certain. So, wow, it's been quite a year. I mean, we're running on fumes, so many of us. I mean, you saw some of the emotions that our leadership team is feeling. Resilience is down. And I think people are doing their best to continue to recharge, refuel, find the flow, not languish as much, if we're quoting Adam Grant. How does that factor into people approaching a difficult conversation? And are there strategies to employ to take people's lowered kind of resilience, generally speaking, into consideration?
Yes. So first of all of us, well, most of us, have lost some of our social skills over this long pandemic period. We've had less social interface. We've spent less time in the physical presence of other people. And even if we've done things like this format or Zoom where we've seen other people, you don't see all the body language, you can't track all the facial cues, so that we're all a little bit rusty. We're probably less attuned to nuance. And given the logistical realities of the pandemic, as well as the physical and emotional ones, we probably have a backlog of difficult conversations, of things that we've wanted to talk about and felt like this isn't the time, it's too difficult right now, people are too stressed. And the thing to remember about that is that ripeness matters. Timeliness helps a difficult conversation a lot. But if we go back to the science that we learned in elementary school, we know heat stored underground, under pressure, erupts dramatically and unpredictably. So that if we build up that backlog and there's a lot of heat underground, better to have a series of small conversations than to have that blowout that then needs a lot of management and repair. I think the other thing in terms of that resilience is to make that you know, depletion is to make it a part of the conversation so that I might open a difficult conversation now, say that I wanted to talk to a colleague about the way we've been sharing assignments. Say, you know, I know it's been a hard year for both of us. I honestly don't know the full extent of how difficult it's been for you. I'd like to hear more about that if you're willing to share. And I'd also like to talk about how it is that we're sharing the workload right now. I've got some concerns about it. I've got some ideas and thoughts. I'm sure you do as well. So I'd want to put it right out there.
Yeah, I love it. Bringing it into the conversation is really about using the dynamic and bringing reality right into it. I think that makes a lot of sense. A lot of people are reacting to some of your points that I want to just bring into our conversation. First, someone gave the tip. Beth Johnson said she prepares using her HR colleagues as a sounding board to practice. I like that too, because I'll tell you, our HR team, they're amazing at helping to practice, helping you make sure you have your points, that you're thinking, you know, about intent and impact. I think that's a great point, Beth. Thank you. And a shout out to our HR colleagues and peers. I love the focus, Jess says, I love the focus on the impact of conflict on our identities. A usual approach from our clinical social work training has been to think about the what is the story I'm telling myself about their identity? How is that impacting the assumptions I'm making about their motivations and capabilities? Great point, Jess. I think that goes right to the heart of some of what you were saying in terms of being very thoughtful about that. That's great. There's a shout out to Craig Landis from PMA, who teaches crucial conversations or has in the past, and they think that that should now be annual mandatory education, a nice AME around crucial conversations. Catherine, that would be pretty good, wouldn't it? You have fire safety and you have crucial conversations. That would be good. I like it. I'd love to hear from the audience.
Fire safety.
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to hear from the audience. What are you doing to take people's lowered resilience into consideration? Are you doing anything differently to give feedback or have these types of difficult conversations now? Have you been holding off, and is the albatross kind of choking you around your neck as you've been putting off difficult conversations? Would love to hear some of the ways that you're kind of thinking about that. Catherine, is there ever a time where not getting into conflict is the better answer, where maybe avoiding conflict actually serves us? And if so, when?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, absolutely, yes. First of all, there's a thing called ripeness. It's a concept that we use in conflict management and mediation. So let's think about an apple tree for a minute. If there's a green apple on the tree, if you've ever been apple picking, it's very hard to pull it off because it's still a part of the tree. And so green conflict, I always try to do a diagnosis. Is the conflict green? Is it ripe or is it rotten? Green conflict is a part of our core identity. Being angry with you, being upset with you, being disappointed in you, being frustrated, that's a part of who I am. And we don't surrender our core identity easily. Ripe apples, they're now a piece of fruit. You can pick them off the tree. I'd have to give it a little tug. Sometimes the tree will just drop them. That's true with ripe conflict. It's something that we're willing to take down and talk about, or it's something that sometimes, just like fruit in an orchard, we're ready to drop. So let's say all those apples drop at the bottom of a tree. You get out in late fall to pick, and they're all starting to rot and ferment. I know that every organization I've worked in, and I'm assuming parts of your organization as well, have what I call rotten conflict. It's stuff that's been there for a long time. It's never been addressed. Every time you're gathered around a table, there's kind of this fermented pile of apples that everybody talks over and around. In that kind of conflict, I really recommend you bring in an expert to deal with it, because people don't like to clean up rotted fruit. People don't like to deal with rotted conflict, and having some specialty techniques help. So yes, one, sometimes it's advisable to wait until things are ripe to talk about them, not rotten, but ripe. Two, sometimes the setting is all wrong. So that, you know, do we want to have difficult conversations in the OR? Absolutely not. In the clinic? Absolutely not. In the hallways? In the elevator? Absolutely not. So setting is a time when avoidance can be a good strategy. I might want to avoid a difficult conversation until I have more information, until I have some cooling off time, until I perceive the other party has some cooling off time, until I know who my allies are, until I know what my rights are, or until, as several other people have mentioned, I have the opportunity to practice and prepare. So that I think avoidance gets a bad name, and chronic avoidance is problematic. Strategic avoidance is part of emotional and strategic intelligence.
I love that. I used to coach a leader, not here, a pen in a previous life, and he had a pretty emotional trigger button that was very sensitive. And so we bought him an egg timer, and we coached him that he needed to turn over the egg timer before he shot off a text, shot off an email, just to breathe and get back into his level of consciousness before he was taking action, and slowing that down, being more thoughtful, being more intentional. It really helped him remind himself. And it was a symbol that sat on his desk, but it also was a practice that he incorporated into how he managed both himself and conflict with others. Many people really resonating with your apple metaphor, especially ripe, not rotten. And I think timing is so important. I want to point out,
if I might, Cindy, really quickly, sure. And that another plug for avoidance, particularly if you're in any kind of a leadership role, is to allow other people to develop their problem-solving skills. So that some of us as leaders with the best of intentions tend to jump in early when we see a problem and not let other people kind of figure out how to solve it themselves. And part of their development is developing that skill. So we may want to use avoidance in that regard, or we may want to go from a problem-solving mode to a coaching mode.
Yeah, I love that. So often I know for myself, I want to be Robin Hood, or I want to be the hero, and I'll fix it all. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, my job, how can I help? How can I support the other person to solve the problem? So I think that's well taken. I want to point out, Kristen Weber said, the lower resilience and higher anxiety is also affecting our patients with difficult diagnoses, which require more patience and listening than usual these days. I mean, we're framing today's discussion about difficult conversations mostly with those with whom we're working. You can also be having difficult conversations with our patients and their family members, because it's just a difficult time. So I think all of this applies. Great point, Kristen. Thank you. How do you protect the relationships despite having to have difficult conversations? So many people take things so personally, even if it's not personal. How do you set yourself up to have a good reaction from the other perspective? Or how do you, you know, have a good relationship despite having to say some hard things to one another?
Again, I think there's always an opportunity to move that into the conversation. You can use it as a part of the opener. You can revisit it, and not as a shield necessarily, nor as a sword, but to be saying, you know, our relationship is really important to me. And it's one of the reasons that I've chosen to talk to you today about X. I value our relationship. I value its, you know, its growth and future. And I'm hoping that in having this conversation, we can each learn something and figure out a way to go forward that's constructive for us both. So again, I'm a fan of putting more into the public conversation and leaving less in your head. Now, having said that, there are many things that are best never leaving your head, and that's called having an edit loop. It's that self-regulation that's a part of emotional intelligence. But in terms of feelings parts of things, I think it's really helpful to just put it out there. I also think it's important after difficult conversations to do what's called checking in the aftermath. So I might have a tough conversation with someone who's a close colleague, a close friend. It could be a patient, patient's family member. And even if whether I feel the conversation's gone well or poorly, always a good idea to follow up. You know, just wanted to touch base to you after we talked this morning or yesterday and see how you're doing. And then if I'm going to ask for a check-in, the next thing I need to do is press the pause button on my own speech and just listen.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. Do you think that if you build a feedback-rich environment where you're consistently giving feedback, both opportunities for development, things that can make someone even better, the positives that they're doing, does that set you up for having a stronger relationship and maybe have some maybe you have fewer harder conversations because you're at least tending to the relationship maintenance ongoing versus kind of letting it all build up to have it be one big conversation. Do you advocate for that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. First of all, I think people really underestimate the value of positive feedback. And it is the least expensive and most highly valued currency that we possess as human beings. And I don't want to veer into the feedback conversation materials that you've already developed, but the one thing about positive feedback is that if it's not specific, it doesn't have as much resonance. So I can just say, gee, great job this afternoon, better than saying nothing. It would be far preferable if I said, Cindy, you really did a great job this afternoon. I love the way you influenced, you know, bringing in the conversations with the audience, getting more participation and the attention you paid to timing. Those things really spoke for me. So that in terms of letting people know what it is, but I agree that if you have more smaller conversations, whether they're feedback conversations, difficult conversations, or addressing a conflict, you don't get into that backlog, because when we get that heat stored underground under pressure, the eruption is more volcanic. It's not like a little steam that escapes from a radiator, and those conversations are a mess. They're really hard to have.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. We've got a ton of tools to help you build a feedback-rich environment. Gretchen put some of them in the chat for you to check out, and we'll happily do some shadow coaching. Your HR, CHROs, HR business partners, they're all there for you to help you create this. We got a question come in from Susan Weinstein. What questions do you ask, Catherine, to determine if conflict is not yet ripe? How do you determine if it's too personal of an issue and if that person's not ready to give it up yet? Any questions or temperature checking that you do?
One, it depends on how well I know the person. And so just, I might, you know, assess based on my own impression. Two, you can start a difficult conversation and put it on hold. So I might open a conversation with somebody and find out that the emotional content is extremely high. And at that point, I may say, wow, you know, it's clear to me that you have a wealth of really strong feelings about this issue that it's important for me to hear. So let's just take a pause right here. I'd really like to hear what's going on with you about this. And then I may not even get to the rest of the conversation that day, that time, but at least I want to give that venting opportunity. The other piece of that, and this is kind of a little sidestep away from that question, is that not all of our conversations go well ever, no matter who you are. And I'm a great believer in the do-over. So that, you know, I can always go back to somebody and say, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that conversation that we had, and it left me feeling unsettled, disappointed in the way that I engaged, and uncertain about where our relationship stands. I wondered if you'd be willing to talk again. And I'm not gonna ambush them in the moment. I think that's not helpful. I'm actually gonna make an appointment to give somebody that reflection time and that preparation time. If they say absolutely not, hell will freeze over before I speak to you again. Then I've got some choices to make. My inclination at that point would be to say, wow, it's clear to me that you have some really strong feelings about this. I respect that. I want to honor your request for more time, and I want to let you know it's important to me that we revisit this. So let's take a break. I'm going to check in with you in another week or so. I don't want to let them know that, oh, okay, fine, hell will freeze over, we'll never speak again. Not helpful.
You know, Catherine, oh my God, this is like solid gold. I think I'm going to watch this replay, rewind it, and write down exactly those words. Because I think if I can like play that in my ear, that could be part of like my prepping. I think some of the ways you phrase that just, it takes all the heat out of it and it opens people up. I know that I've had that situation where I didn't handle something very beautifully and I went to somebody and they were open to me revisiting it or having a do-over, and people have come to me and asked for a do-over. And what's amazing is the power of that vulnerability by saying, could have done that better. Like, it makes me like that person even if I'm mad at them. So I really like the way you put that out there, and I think that also tends to the relationship. I've got a question that came up last week or last show. And we do read all your questions, and if I can bring them in, I do. Last week, we had somebody said, could we ask the moderators to give some advice on how to handle emotional or other when their leaders don't model the leadership models and values you espouse to? So I thought that that could be appropriate here, because it perhaps could lead to giving some conversation or feedback or having a difficult conversation with one superior or boss, can you, I know you said that don't, you may not ask them to start, rather you want to, you know, have your time be very valued with that leader. And so you should put your stuff out there first. Are there other tips when giving feedback to superiors or having a difficult conversation if perhaps there's difficulty in that relationship?
Yes. First, I think it's helpful, and not all leaders require this, but some do, in some way as I open the conversation, to acknowledge their status. And that might be something to say like, you know, look, I know that ultimately this decision is going to be yours. There's a lot of factors that you're considering and a lot of constituents that you need to work with. So I'm putting out there that, you know, I get it. This is yours. And then it's up to me whether I wanted to add something like, and of course I'll support whatever you decide. I'm only going to say that if it's true, but I do want to acknowledge in some way that there's a differential here. And that person faces pressures. I think what we often forget about leaders and leadership is that part of leadership is receiving gift wrapped problems every day. And that in a sense, the UPS of problems makes deliveries all day, every day. And it's not very often that people come with gift wrapped solutions or proposals for solutions. So I want to acknowledge that status. And then I want to tell that person what it is that matters to me and why. However, I want to frame that in a way that isn't an evaluative judgment on them, so that if one of the espoused values of the organization, you know, caring and respect, and I feel that this person is uncaring and disrespectful, I don't want to open the conversation with basically saying, I'd like to talk to you about how wrong you really are. In my whole life, both as a trainer.
I don't think that's going to go too well.
No one has ever said to me, sounds good, let's get coffee, it could take a while. So how can I open the conversation in a way that says, you know, it's part of the important values of Penn Medicine to be caring and respectful. I'm working on that with my own leadership style. I wondered if we could talk about, you know, some pointers you may have about how you incorporate that. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the tools that I'm working on to get your feedback on them. So can I slide in a lesson, but do it in a way that I'm asking somebody for feedback and advice? Then I want to do things in the language of request rather than demand. If I'm having a difficult conversation going up, I want to think long and hard before I go in and demand for X, so that, you know, I'd like you to think about what I see as a growing problem in this particular area. And here's the data that I'm sharing with you. You know, this is why I see that. And I want to be thinking about what I know about the person. Are they more a systems? Are they a numbers thinker? Are they going to need graphs? Are they going to need charts? Are they more a feelings thinker? How do I present that? Then I want to listen to what it is they're going to have to say, because surely there's going to be something back. And I also want to frame it in a way to make it clear what's in it for them to take action on this. And that's true for all of us, not just leaders. We're generally inspired to agree to things that meet some of our own self-interest. So to help somebody to see why addressing this particular issue or this particular problem advances their leadership and the objectives for their role.
Thanks. Deb asks, what do you do if you don't always feel so safe having that conversation? Is that data that you should really listen to? Do you plan differently? Do you perhaps not have the conversation? What if there are possible repercussions and you're afraid?
I think that often, I don't want to say anytime, but often when we have a conversation going up, and it can be as true with peers or even subordinates, but we feel like there's a risk, and there could be a risk of, you know, some kind of blowback, some kind of, you know, agenda, some kind of whatever. And it's a very personal, individual calculus of risk whether we decide to have that conversation. Depending on what the stakes are, I might do some consulting with trusted friends, with mentors, possibly with HR. You know, there may be some other area in terms of an equity office that I'd want to consult with about having the conversation. Are there people who are peers of the person that I wish to talk to that I have any kind of trusted mentor relationship with? Could I seek their advice? And again, if I were going to seek their advice, it wouldn't be to say, you know, I'd really like to go talk to, you know, my boss and your colleague X because he or she is failing in this, but to say, you know, I really admire your leadership style. I want to have a conversation with X, and I'd like to emulate some of what I've learned from you. Could you help me to think about how I might best approach this and what you see as some of the risks? So sometimes I think, yes, it's worth it to not have the conversation. Other times I think it's a very individual calculus of risk. However, I'm very pro having difficult conversations. And as I said earlier, martyrdom is very high stakes. However, going into a difficult conversation, knowing you have some alternatives can give you a feeling of strength and protection. You know, and those alternatives might be, you know, knowing that there's some outside help available, knowing that there's a possibility of an intervention available, or knowing that you have some other alternative, that basically you've got a parachute to help you bail out if you need to.
Excellent. Thanks for the question, Deb. And let me recognize Dr. Christy Weber. I didn't mean to say Kristen Weber. It was definitely on the chat that way. Christy, I apologize. She gives you a big shout out, Catherine, and is a big fan just like me. So the time's going so fast. I feel like I could do another whole show with you, Catherine. You're so good. MS Teams, Zoom, is it the same skills in terms of having these difficult conversations in this virtual world? What are you coaching people to do differently?
So in a difficult conversation, nuance is super important. And so facial expression, body language, all of those things matter a lot. What does that say to me? Personally, I do not have difficult conversations via email or text ever. I only use them as scheduling devices to have a more media-rich engagement. Whole host of reasons for that. I could go on for hours and I won't, but if nothing else, let's just take a simple email example. I write an email to Cindy and I say, I like that idea. Cindy opens the email and says, woo, Catherine likes the idea. If we were in person, I could have said, I like the idea. I like the idea. So you've lost all that. Yeah. So in terms of formats like this, I prefer Zoom or, you know, any one of these models, MS Teams, to the phone, again, because of media richness. You lose that body language. You lose those visual signalings. If I'm going to use a medium like this, what do I want to think about? Number one, limit the audience. Who has to be there? I don't want bystanders to a difficult conversation, because then it becomes theater. And if the emotions are high, it becomes opera. And what do we know about opera? Somebody always dies at the end. So no theater, no audience, limit the audience. Two, I want to do more frequent check-ins, and not to the obnoxious point of, oh, I think what Cindy just said was this. And I mean, don't do the parrot facilitation, but just right. Periodically checking in and saying, you know, we've been talking, you know, for a couple minutes now about how it is that we think we're going to restructure this part of the organization. Just want to check in with everybody and sort of get some feedback on where you think this is going. And I want to do a fair amount of recap, because I think that in this kind of modality where you have the opportunity to multitask invisibly, I want to make sure that people are still on path. I don't want to assume that just because I can see somebody's face on the screen that they aren't minding a child, feeding a dog, tying a shoe, doing whatever. So some more of the recap.
Thank you. Catherine, several people agree with me that we're going to have you come back at some point. Your knowledge is just so both pragmatic and magical. I'm just so grateful that you were able to join us today. The tips have been fantastic and really great timely reminder in terms of some of the things that we're facing. So I just can't say thank you enough for agreeing to come meet with me, have this conversation with our colleagues here at Penn Medicine. And thank you for being an expert in this area. We're just really lucky to have you for this hour to learn from you and your gifts. I want to just shout out. Yeah, thank you. I want to shout out our next show. We've been working on a great lineup. Oh, we got a little flickering. It's our strobe light effect here. We've got a great lineup for you. I don't know if it's going to stop blinking, but our spotlight on new leaders is our next show on May 6th. We're going to have James Dimitriadis, the new CEO of Penn Medicine Princeton Health, and John Herman, our new CEO of Lancaster General Health. You are going to like them very much. And this is your opportunity really to get to meet them, hear what they're thinking about professionally, get to know them a little bit personally. I think it's going to be fantastic. We have a great lineup in the next couple of months, so I hope that you'll continue to tune in. We have Growing Up Penn Medicine with Peter Quinn and Lori Gustav. They have spent the majority of their careers here at Penn. They're pretty funny, especially Peter. I think they've got some great stories to share in terms of what they've seen in the past, present, and future state of Penn and Penn Medicine. So I think you won't want to miss that show either. We'll be announcing our rest of the lineup for the summer. Hopefully by next show, we're working on some really fun things for our one-year anniversary and for our shows this summer. So I want to thank each of you for joining us today. Thank you for all that you continue to do. I know that many of you are just continuing to plug along through difficult circumstances. So thank you for taking the time to come together with us in community. Thank you for all you're doing. We're so grateful for you. Keep your feedback coming. We are listening. So with that, I'll look forward to seeing you on the next show. Take care, everyone.